I want to thank all y'all for joining me this evening on Dante's Old South. I am your humble host, Clifford Brooks, and it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. Now, I'm not going to waste your time right up front because we have a ton of artists and music to light your mind, body, and spirit. Now, before we get this bad boy going, I want to thank Wild Honey Tees, The Crown, Mercer University Press, Mr. Classic Haberdashery, The Woodbridge Inn, Mostly Mutts, and The Red Phone Booth. Now, let's get this show started with Shaken by David Shaw. And up now on Dante's, we have professor and poet Annette Sisson. Annette, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you, Clifford.
Now, we have a review of your new book, in the current issue of the Blue Mountain Review, and I urge people to go check that out. There will be a link to it in the show notes. And as a poet myself, I always jump on with both feet the all-important first question of why do you write poetry?
Let's see. I suppose to some extent, writing poetry allows me to process and explore life and the world. But also, it's just the pure act of creation, of making something, of crafting something where there was nothing. And that's very satisfying. Sometimes it's very frustrating when it's not going well, but it's very satisfying. So I would say with both of those answers, whether it's about processing and exploring the world or just the pure act of creation, I'm trying to offer something. I would say I'm offering something.
Now, to offer people something, artists often have a place or rituals that they follow, or both, in order to get in the correct headspace and channel the right energy to bring that something to life. Do you have any rituals, rules that you follow or you write or during the process?
Well, I write better when I already have some ideas written down. But I think one thing that is probably unique to me is my favorite place to write, and that is in the passenger seat of a moving car or on a moving train. I teach in England pretty often, about every other summer, and I spent a whole semester there in the spring of 22 teaching students. And there's something about the motion, the movement, the view. It stirs something. It kind of shakes something loose for me. So my husband says, oh, I do have to have quiet, though. So he now listens to he's got hearing aids, and he's able to listen to the radio through his hearing aids, because he used to say, it's very boring for me while you're sitting there in the silence looking at clouds. But then he says it's hilarious because at some point, then your pen just starts going. Because I do start on the page. There's something about the tactile experience of starting on the page. I have written poems before on the computer, but it's rare. But I go to the computer pretty soon after I have a draft. But I do prefer to write on paper. So,
well, the widely held philosophy that, well, I hold, is that the first draft is like the gooey stuff. Hard work comes when you sit down to edit. How do you tackle the often painstaking, but beautifully tedious process of editing?
Well, a couple of things here. I started playing piano when I was 5, so that attention to detail, that self-discipline, got honed in me really early. And then for a while, I was an editor. I love the revision process. That's 90 to 95% of the writing. Getting something down on the page, I mean, it's always just like, you know, not very good. You know, but we got to start somewhere. I'm not one of those people who I can't say ever. I've had a few poems that I felt like fell out of the sky and were pretty easy to write. But for me, most of the work, most of the writing is the rewriting. And I think of it like sculpting, like I'm making a sculpture, and I'm just honing and cutting and sharpening, and I love it. Now, I will say, maybe all poets have these moments where I really do think this poem is as close to finished as a poem ever is. A poem is really never finished. But you get to that point where you're like, there's nothing else. And I don't really love hearing from somebody else that they do think I need some changes, you know? That's, I have this quiet resistance. But then most of the time I do listen. Because I know very well, if I let a poem sit for several months and come back to it, I'll see something I never saw when I was in that obsessive, intensive process of creating the poem in the first place. So,
now, editing, I've I found that you dig in, you have to be in that place when that thing happened or those events took place. Did you ever find that there were some things that you thought you'd never heal from that amazingly over time you had, and maybe some things you thought you'd long put to bed that in the editing process to be there, you found maybe you hadn't healed from so much?
Yes. I am amazed by how many poems I need to write about my mother, who passed away in 2018. They just keep bubbling up. And I keep thinking, well, I'm finished with that, but I'm not. And so I'm a little surprised by that. That is actually what propelled me to start taking my writing seriously. Like I started writing poems when I was in the third grade. But then I never, and in college, I was a creative writing minor and a lit major. But I didn't allow for that in my life until, like, to take it really seriously until 2017, 2018. And it was my mother's third diagnosis of cancer. They were all unrelated. She had three kinds of cancer in her life, and this one was terminal. And I found myself at a faculty retreat, and they suggested writing. And this woman, we were at her house, and she had horses. And she suggested we go out in the barn on break and commune with the horses. And I'm not really a horse girl, but I had this weird experience where this horse looked me directly in the eye. And then when we came back in, she said, I'd like you to write about something and process, you know, what's been happening in your life. And I ended up writing a poem about that experience with a horse. And I've just been writing ever since, because I really realized that it was difficult this time, knowing that mom was not going to last. And I don't see my writing as just therapy, but it is helpful. It is helpful to have to sit down and think about those things in your life and figure out how to create things about them. I think it's healing.
And in that healing and writing, for the satisfaction of itself too, as far as poetic craft, are there other components and techniques that you adore that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah. So people say my poems are pretty imagistic. I would say that's probably true. I love language, but even more, I love music. And I mentioned I started playing piano when I was five. And I think for me, if a poem doesn't have the music of language in it, I'm not finished with it yet. The music is really important to me. It's almost more important than what it means or what I'm saying is how I'm saying it. I wouldn't say I'm a language poet, but I'm a language-ish poet.
That needs to be on the front of your book. That's amazing. And talking about your book, let's get to the meat of it before I let you go, because that's going to happen. Tell us about your book.
Yes. So this is my first full-length book. I did have a chapbook before this, and it was published last May, so May 2022, by Glass Flyer Press. They're in Illinois, up by Chicago. It's called Small Fish in High Branches, and that's kind of an odd title, but there's a poem in it called To See Small Fish in High Branches, and there's a nature preserve very near where I live, and we walk there a lot. It's called Radnor Lake, and there are a lot of blue herons there. And one day, my husband and I were walking around the lake, and we looked up in this tree where they like to nest, and there were hatchlings in the nest, and we literally saw fish in the tree because the parents, we saw it glinting in the sun, the silver fish that they were feeding the babies. And I just thought, oh, that is amazing. So I wrote a poem about it, and then that became the title of my book. And a friend from college who's an amateur photographer, but I don't know why, because he seems very professional to me, had this gorgeous photograph of a blue heron landing on a lake. And I was able to ask him if I could use that on the front of my book. So that was wonderful. But I'm really grateful to Amy, Kay, and all the people at Glass Flyer for picking this book up.
Now, where can we go online to find it and buy it?
If you just Google Glass Flyer Press, and that'll take you directly to their website, and then you click on bookstore. And actually, right now, because it's their 10th anniversary, they're having a sale. So all the books are $10 instead of $16.
Nice. But before we let you go, last but not least, I know my listening public would love to hear a poem from you.
Okay. So I'm going to read one of my favorite poems from the book. I'm very close to my daughter. My daughter is now 27. And after college, she moved back home with us for a while, and then she moved away. And she was only away a couple years, but of course, at this time, I didn't know how long she would live in a distant city. And I was trying to make my peace with that. And so this poem is kind of a blessing. Also, my husband and I had just been out to Yellowstone Park and all out west, and we had seen the sandhill cranes. And I really loved that experience, so I sort of mashed those things together in this poem. It's called Your Desire, a Loaded Spring, for my daughter. Your eyes drift west. I feel the distance rise. The driveway cracks are widening. The sagging bookshelves undusted in the half-vacant bedroom that was yours. Did I tell you the vocal cords of sandhill cranes measure 5 feet, their bodies just 3? The cords coil like French horns, their stentorian bugles rattling for miles. Their bodies, lithe and strong-legged, ballerinas with scarlet turbans, seem hardly able to contain such freight, to emit such cries. And the corkscrews inside, the springs that propel their flight, wings unfurling as they leap, heads pumping low. Last May, I heard the sandhills call as they launched, clamoring high above the marsh, becoming invisible. I saw your coiled body, your desire, a loaded spring. Your voice is the overtures before the dancers' buoyant cabrioles, before the crane's sacramental journey to the Platte.
That is beautiful. That is beautiful. And the music, it is. It's a conversation for another time, because we will have you back on, but I've always been fascinated by the elasticity of the boundary between poetry and songwriting.
Yes.
And I feel very similar. And we'll talk off camera, as it were, about what you said about music. And I mean it, as your career continues to blossom, because I believe that you're still only, a foothold into how beautiful what it is you're about to create. We'll have you back on, because it's been a true delight to have you on this time.
Thank you so much, Clifford. I've totally enjoyed it.
That's great. And it's Sizzen. May all the blessings in the world be upon you in heaven above. And if you have anything new to tell me, please call me. We'll have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before we bring on our next guest, let's hear Sometimes I Pray by Jacob Bryant.
Lord knows I try. I ain't as tough as I seem sometimes, as much as I fight. Tonight I'm leaning on the bottle with a Bible in my hand and kneeling like you taught me by this empty king-size bed. And sometimes I pray, but not like I would if you were here. Sometimes I drink a little more than I should to fight back the tears. Sometimes I pray pain time after time. And I've walked a fine line between hell and playing with fire. And I still wonder why he listens as I stumble for words with that red and white. Every single verse. Yeah, sometimes I pray, but not like I would if you were here. Sometimes I drink a little more than I should to fight back the tears.
And now on Dante's, we have program manager of the UCLA Extension Writers Program and novelist, Nichelle Ann Windsor. Nichelle, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Happy to be here today.
We have a great deal to talk about. I, for one, am an avid fan of the UCLA Extension Writers Program, and you were one of the first people to make me comfortable in it. So tell us first, you worked in nonprofits. How did working with nonprofits lead you to work for the UCLA Extension Writers Program?
Yeah, so way back in 2010, which feels like, I don't know, 1,000 years ago, I actually started a nonprofit writing group called the Children's Book Writers of Los Angeles. And that's based off of my experience with when I first started writing, that was also in 2010, I attended my first ever writing conference. And that's where I learned, like, you don't bring a 250,000 word novel, a middle grade novel, to a conference. Like, oh, man, I got a lot to learn. And they were like, oh, you should join, you know, SCBWI, a Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators, which is another one of the groups that I helped to co-lead. I'm the co-regional advisor for the LA region as well. And so joining that group and kind of missing it during the summer because we had a little bit of a break for the little mingles, I was like, oh, you know, we need one in our area. And I live in Torrance. We didn't have a little SCBWI mingle there. So I started my own group, Children's Book Writers of Los Angeles. And from there, it kind of just blossomed into this nonprofit. So it's kind of interesting. Like all of my work there and for SCBWI as well has been free. I basically just do it because I just love doing it. I love putting on events and seeing people's faces kind of light up when they're like, oh my gosh, this is really cool being, you know, surrounded by writers and learning all this stuff about writing. So a lot of that is just like my own time and money. And then eventually, I guess I would say in 2014, my sister was looking for a job and found this like little description, and she sent it to me. She's like, I think this job would be perfect for you. And it was for a creative writing program representative at the UCLA Extension Writers Program. And it described everything that I already did for free.
Right.
Paid gigs. I was like, yes, I think this is it. So I applied. I think I was the first one they interviewed. And so it took like a month before I heard back from them. And I was like emailing like, hello, I really interview. Any news, you know, kind of thing. So I was really excited when they called me back for a second interview. And after that interview, I was the second interview was with the director and the program manager at the time, Linda and Cindy, which is two of them. And when I left that room, I was like, I got this. I have a feeling I got this. And I was like whistling on the way to, you know, parking lot. And then I just kind of sat down on the bench, kind of took it all in. I was like, that was a really great interview. I think this job is meant for me. And then like literally 5 minutes later, before I even got to the parking lot, I got a phone call from HR. And they were like, we would love to offer you the job. So I was like, yes. Yeah. So I was really, really stoked. It's like, I would do this job for free anyways. And now I get paid for it and I get to work with amazing, you know, coworkers. And so that's how I got into the UCLA Extension Writers Program. So.
To hear how excited you are, how altruistic, wisely altruistic you are. What was it about the way you grew up that created you into the person you are now?
That's a really great question. Well, I think, you know, I was born and raised in the Philippines, and the culture is very sort of like social. You know, you grow up being taught to sort of, you know, respect your elders and kind of help out wherever you can. And so that was sort of just my thing. I remember in my first ever SCBWI working writers retreat that I attended as an attendee, I saw this opportunity to be like, man, this is such a great experience. Why don't we have like, you know, group photos or something? Nobody does this. So I just kind of went up to the organizers and I was like, hey, I have a nice camera. Would you like me to take group photos? And they were like, oh, that's a great idea. And so after that, I kind of just like, you know, sent an email to everybody with the photos I took, just not expecting anything. I just wanted it for myself too, because it was such a really amazing event. And then lo and behold, the following year, they were like, would you like to take photos again? And also, would you like to volunteer?
Right.
So it kind of just led there. And same with a, you know, nonprofit group I started. I think I just knew that in my own sort of journey as a writer, I kind of struggled. Because I had to look for all this information by myself. I didn't have money to go to like, you know, an MFA or an MA program like that. So
right.
Reach. And I was like, well, you know, the best way you can learn is by teaching is what I've heard. So, you know, maybe I'll gather all this info and just kind of start doing the workshops on my own. I was an English teacher, so I had that sort of background.
Right.
Anyways. Right. And that just kind of all started from there. And then once I grew my membership in the group, then I started inviting other, you know, writers that I would meet, you know, at conferences and meetups and stuff. And so that's, I was like, all right, I'm done with the building of the curriculum. Now I'm inviting people and kind of growing the network. And so that kind of just, you know, started from there.
Now you've taught, and they say that those who can't do teach, which I find one of the worst lies in the history of mankind. That doesn't apply to you because you do write and you do write well. I have experienced it. No, I'm going to don't be humble. Don't be humble. That's not what we do here. I mean it. And they'll be able to see it in the upcoming issue of the Blue Mountain Review. But before they can taste that, you have a book coming out. So tell us about your personal creative endeavors.
Oh, well, I mean, I hope the book comes out. Right now, my agent is currently, we're on submission. So she sent out my young adult fantasy novel out on submission last October. So we're waiting to hear back from some publishers that she had submitted to. But it's basically a story that's really based on my own sort of personal experience. It's fantasy, but you know, isn't fiction all about the truth? So, it took me forever to kind of figure out what the story was about. And that's why it took me like 12 years to actually turn it from just this idea into a manuscript that an agent would even accept. But, you know, that's also a big part of that is really me having to grow as well as, you know, not just as a writer, but as a person. Like all of these experiences filtered into the story, and that's when it came alive, you know. So it was a long journey, but we got there.
And the journey, it's so cheesy. Some things are cliche because they're true, but the journey, it is the destination. Oh, I feel so cheesy saying that. But it is, because it never stops. The UCLA program, the Extension Writers, as we were talking about, off camera, as it were, it's one of the few that really that tackle the practical of it. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that in the answer that you just gave previously about how, you know, the submission process, how you get it, you know, an agent, how it's a community effort, but also how there's a practical intuitiveness that goes into your writing process, as I understand that. So tell us more about that.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, okay. So one of the reasons that it took forever to actually make sense of my story was because I was writing from maybe the perspective of somebody who's, you know, kind of very new to this whole kind of publishing in the U.S. thing. And, you know, when I first started, it was all about trends, you know, like 12 years ago, you didn't really see sort of as much diversity in the books that I read anyways. And so I was kind of following the prescribed, like, okay, well, we have this protagonist. She's an American, you know, this is her family. And it just felt like it was missing something. And then as I kind of like grew my network and started doing a lot of these, you know, kind of critique sessions and workshops and conferences and stuff, I was like, wait, what's missing is really me. Like, I don't have any of me reflected in this story at all. And so that's when everything sort of shifted. And I started not just kind of like writing about, you know, sort of Greek mythology, which is kind of part of the story, but I started putting in Philippine mythology in there in my book. And that's when everything came. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to talk about, you know, what it's like being half of everything. Like, my protagonist is, you know, biracial, bisexual, mm-hmm. by everything.
Right.
People have to, you know, it's like, it kind of being in the middle of two cultures and stuff, which is what I always felt, even though I was, you know, born and raised in the Philippines and my parents are Filipino, I always felt like I had like this, you know, sort of affinity towards, yeah, my mom is like an American citizen, so that's right. It. And my dad is Filipino. So I always felt like sort of, ooh, where do I fit? I'm not right. a typical like Filipino person, but I'm also not your typical American. So where is that? And so it became sort of that journey of discovering myself kind of filtered into my story. And really this story is about a 16-year-old girl who searches for her deadbeat dad, only to discover that he is the head of a magical supremacist group, basically intent on eradicating, you know, people like her.
Right.
And that was kind of born from my experience too of growing up thinking my dad was dead, but he wasn't. It's like my mom was trying to protect me, you know, from sort of being kind of like emotionally hurt. And so she didn't want me to feel like I was abandoned and stuff. So kind of growing up a little bit and meeting him when I was 16 and kind of learning the truth, so a lot of that emotion kind of went into the making of the book, and I needed to be the kind of person who could process that, you know, right. in a story in order to write it. But what really kind of unlocked everything for me was when I started The Artist Way by Julia Cameron, which was prescribed to me by, you know, a writing friend, actually one of my coworkers at the writer's program. And so I started this and I began to realize, wow, there is a lot of intersection between creativity and spirituality, which nobody talks about.
No.
But it's so important. And that is what allowed me to unlock this like sort of intuition because for the longest time, every single revision I made of that book, I just felt like something was off, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And then when I went through this artist way, I was like able to be like, you know what? This draft isn't working. I'm going to like start anew. And then version 12 was when everything came together because I was allowing sort of myself to kind of go by feel as opposed to by logic, which is weird. And that's when it all came together. That's the book that I submitted to my agent and what got me an agent, actually. So, yeah.
When you put both hands around your spirituality, as it were, and it sets you on a firm course to not only find yourself, but find yourself in the story. When you sit down to write, if you do sit down to write, what are some of the practical craft steps you go through to get into the headspace to do what you need to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the tools that I really kind of picked up from the artist way was the morning pages. It really allowed me to sort of ground myself. So every morning I wake up at 5 and when everything else is still kind of very quiet, I sit down and I just start doing the 3 pages of free writing, kind of just letting whatever comes through. And then eventually that evolved into like automatic writing, which is another thing which I chanced upon. You know, when you start learning about spirituality, you kind of want all sorts of amazing, wonderful things that you were not aware of. So that sort of really helped me. And sometimes I would actually ask questions in the morning pages, like, okay, I'm a little bit blocked, like this scene isn't working. Do you have any ideas? And I don't know what it is, if it's like, you know, whatever, guides or just kind of my inner intuition coming out on the page. But then I would come up with, you know, with certain like answers to my own questions, which is kind of like a really cool way of tapping into. I think we all have that natural sort of guidance system inside of us that we just don't hear too often because, you know, lots of distractions all around. So it's nice to have that quiet time. I think that was a very big part of it. And also having kind of time to just quiet down. So I usually start like with a meditation, just kind of like quiet, really not really doing any kind of breathing exercise, just 10 minutes on the timer, just quieting down and just kind of like trying to visualize what the day is supposed to look like. Those are the two major practices that I have, which kind of like help me stay grounded and then, you know, feed into my writing as well.
How do you balance your professional life and your creative life?
Isn't that the question that we all have? Yeah. Oh my gosh. And it's such an important question, especially, you know, this was a very difficult for me to finish the book, not just because I was trying to find out what my story was really about and trying to learn more about myself as a writer, but also because here I am with a full-time job, right? And then I have 2 other nonprofits that I volunteer for. Like, where does writing come in? But what really helped was one of our instructors at the writer's program said, listen, this is a trick. Every day, just say, I'm going to write just 1 line. And so I started with that. I just started with 1 line. And then we had another instructor say, I just do 12 minutes a day. That's all I really give myself. And then if I go beyond the 12 minutes, then great. If I don't, then I've done my part. And so kind of like stealing, I should say, not stealing, but allowing myself to, have that sort of freedom to be like, you know, maybe 12 minutes is all I can afford today because I'm tired. My brain cells aren't. Right. And then sometimes that leads into like an hour and a half, which is wonderful. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes it's like 12 minutes and you're done and you're like, I'm going to bed. It's been a long day.
Right. I do.
Whatever time I can, sneaking in some, you know, moments of writing here and there.
Well, we'll see that. And I'm not trying to jinx anything, but I know your novel's going to come out. I mean, I don't see how it can't. I feel like, no, when I'm Southern and we are a jinxy people, but I promise you. And you're going to come out and they'll be able to see. We even did your interview in the Blue Mountain Review in the first way in microfiction form. So they'll get to see exactly how inventive you are. And to know that it's not flattery, because flattery is the only socially acceptable way to lie, and that's not what we do on NPR. So, Nichelle Ann Windsor, it has been absolutely fantastic to have you on. And when your book does land, we'll have you right back on.
Oh, man, that would be amazing. Yeah, let's, visualize that and, hope it happens.
Manifest it is. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
Let's lighten the load for a second with Young by Alicia Blue.
Everybody tells you don't grow old. I'm so tired of feeling young and all alone. Goodbye, green, I'm coming for the crazy scenes. My baby's got wings. The child inside of me is waking up. She quit drinking all the milk from the same old cup. Thought I was coming to the dark side, but my baby's feeling fine.
Ooh. And now on Dante's Old South, we have poet, writer, and comedian, Brooke McKinney. Brooke, how are you this evening?
Great, Cliff. How are you?
I'm fine and dandy like sour candy, and we are going to start this interview without being boring. I'm not going to ask you who you were as a child. I'm going to ask you who you are as a storyteller.
Good. Okay. Well, I'm probably going to tell you who I was as a child anyway. Who I am as a storyteller. I do think it probably began as a child because where I grew up and stories were kind of all we knew. It's how we learned and interacted with the world or related to the world. My grandmother, especially, she was kind of my inspiration for storytelling. She told stories morning, day, and night. We would sit there and shuck corn and all day, bucket after bucket, and all she had were stories. And for a while, she worked as a in-home caregiver, and she was taking care of people pretty much in their last days. And I do remember being there with her after school. I would get dropped off there or stay with her on the weekends, and she would she'd be piddling around the house, and I would always sort of be like the company for the patients that were living there, who were mostly bedridden at the time. But what I noticed in looking back is that they all had this sort of sweet, sometimes sad desperation to be heard. And all they wanted to do was tell stories about, you know, loss, regrets, dreams, love. It didn't matter. Just that's what they wanted to do. And they just wanted someone to sit and listen. So that's kind of, you know, who I was as a child. I was sitting listening to stories. I think that translates to now because I can remember when one would pass and then she would move on to the next home and I'd go stay with her at that home. And it was sort of just, you know, obviously sad at times because this person would go. And honestly, I don't know what I was thinking then as a kid. I was thinking about it, but it was kind of terrifying. I remember thinking that because I would just get, I didn't know these people. I didn't grow up with these people, but I would attach to things pretty quickly, and I still do. But I was attaching to them through their stories, you know?
Yeah.
And then when they would pass on, I would almost freak out of like, well, no, they've got more to say, or where did they go? You know, it wasn't something then that I could understand, but I know now, like, that's what I want to do. I want to tell stories because I don't want to lose any of it, you know?
You keep the dead alive. You do.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there was one man who he talked about, you know, how he never found the love of his life. But then you have someone else who's like, oh, I found them, and then they got away. And there was just always, you know, stories of love and unfortunately loss. But I attached myself to those stories and still did.
You've attached yourself to the truth. And it's why when I found you online and I read what you were doing online and knew that you had been connected with the Beck Honorary Center, the programs that you've been involved with, none of it is shocking. Because the quality of your work, even in blog posts that are flippantly written that you've sat down in maybe 5 minutes to pen, there's a beauty in it that hangs in the way that you speak. My question from all of that, and hearing the poetry in it, how do you tell those same kind of stories in poetry?
Well, it's kind of difficult to talk about poetry. you know, I think that with poetry, we can tell it with metaphor or images or just, you know, straightforward, like sort of narrative poetry. But it's hard for sometimes for me to think of poetry as like just this thing that we write or that we share or publish. I kind of see it as like a way of being. It's kind of how it's how I live. It's how I'm in the world. It's hard to describe, really. I know with the poems that I've written recently have come from my relationships with my uncles growing up and my stepfather growing up, who were all shared the same experience of being in the Vietnam War. And while I don't, obviously, am not qualified to talk about that experience, I've never been to war, but I always try to understand my relationship with them. It's a very different relationship with anyone else around me in my family. And I was sort of always haunted by that. And I was always trying to understand it. So I think poetry for me was a way of trying to capture that sort of, it's a very complicated, like, human experience that you can't really grasp. And so for me, poetry is the constant of trying to get a little closer to that understanding. If that makes any sense, I don't know.
It makes an enormous amount of sense. And there's a seriousness and a respect there that must be the foundation of a story well told, and it can be a weight on the soul. And the way I think, or it seems that you've dealt with it, is by adding the occupation of comedian in that. Do you find that getting up and being able to tell jokes allows you to better bear the weight of telling the story of your uncles and your father, step up in the Vietnam War?
Comedy is definitely a different kind of storytelling. And it's funny because I've only been doing the stand-up now for like 2 years, but it's something I always wanted to try ever really since high school, but I have horrible stage fright and terrified of talking to people or in front of people. Some people will read a couple of my poems like, wow, that's really depressing, bro. Like, what are you, and they're like, and then you turn around and get on stage and then you sort of, bring humor into it. But I think, and a lot of people have, talked about how, sometimes the only way through it is the humor. For my memoir in progress, Creatures Like Us, I talk a lot about, my parents' divorce, how traumatic that can be. A lot of that was like, I pulled away from people and was more emotionally connected to animals, especially dogs. But there's also this thing of looking back and seeing how I handled things as a child, which is actually really hilarious in some instances. For example, and this won't make any sense right now, but I can remember when I was younger, my parents would fight constantly. And like, eventually my mother would yell at my father, I'm sick of you giving me those ultimatums. I'm sick of you giving me those ultimatums all the time. And, what I heard on the other side of the wall was old tomatoes. And, for a while, literally, I thought my family was falling apart because my father was like buying and delivering old tomatoes to my mother. So
it is kind funny.
It's funny. But it's little things like that, and the bit goes, it goes on and on. Like the comedy is like some mother writing. It's storytelling. There's a callback and it kind of comes, full circle to a story. Hopefully, at least that's what I try to do. But yeah, we all have tragedy, but there's also comedy, and it all kind of ties together depending on how you, want to cope with it.
It's true. And it's mirrored to a degree in your book of poetry that's coming out this fall. Tell us about the publisher and the book and where we can find it online when it's released.
So the poetry book is called The Distance Between Birds, and it's coming out in October from Finishing Line Press. And yeah, it'll be available on their website, Amazon, and a few other places. Also, it'll be available through my website, storysouth.com.
That's it.
Good. Brooke McKinney, a poet and a writer and a comedian. Your book, The Space Between Birds, comes out this fall, correct? From Finishing Line Press?
Yeah, The Distance Between Birds.
Now, when it does come out, I would very much like you to come on the show again and talk about it if it's okay with you.
Yeah, I'd be happy to, Cliff. I'm lucky to be here today. Thank you.
No problem. Before we have on our next guest, let me thank you again, Brooke, and you are welcome in here anytime.
I walked every canyon in this town, trying to figure myself out. How'd I need so much space in LA when nobody's ever around? And it almost drove me crazy, almost drove me from my head. And still we call it beautiful when the sunset meets the smog. And still I say that I'm doing well, even when I'm not. Dog days in LA, in LA. I met a girl in the valley at my friend's, even helped her get a gig, but she don't remember my name. I meet her over and over again, and still we call it beautiful when the sunset meets the smog. And still I say that I'm doing well, even when I'm not. And still we call shoes and stare at the library where all the books are new. And still we call it beautiful when the sunset meets the smog. And still I say that I'm doing well, even when I'm not. And still
thank y'all again for sitting with me this evening on Dante's Old South. I'm your host, Clifford Brooks, and I pray you enjoyed the time with our guests and jammed a bit with for the tunes we brought before you. Before I let y'all go, I want to thank again NPR and WUTC, Wild Honey Tees, The Crown, Mercer University Press, Mr. Classics, Haberdashery, the Woodbridge Inn, Mostly Mutts, and the Red Phone Booths. If y'all want to see what I do in all of its glory, please go over to www.cliffbrooks.com. There you'll find my creative writing classes and other courses for those with latent life diagnosed autism on Teachable by looking up the Brooks Sessions. September 5th, 2023, we'll see my next book of poetry called Old Gods from Mercer University Press. And I'll say goodnight to y'all with a poem from Old Gods called Wolf. Wolf. Be it Beowulf or Virginia Woolf, heroism is in my undrowned life, lifting rocks from deep pockets. Not heroic, deaf against silence, wonderfully made, unafraid, content, and undulant. I might be that bird dancing while casting a net for people. No cry, no foul, no church, wrong derby. I am a monstrous barn owl. Wear the hat and cravat of a bona fide man, the smell of leather and the sternum pregnant with laughter. Be it Beowulf or Virginia Woolf, be Beethoven, sitting up, deciding solitude is company enough.